Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm John Keimel. Today we take you to Northport and the Maine Development Foundation's annual meeting for a talk by Nick Spitzer, host of American Roots and professor of anthropology and American studies at Tulane University. His talk is entitled Roots to Roots, Continuity and Creativity in the Cultural Economy of Maine. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Chancellor of the University of Maine System, Rich Patenaude.
Good morning. I'm Rich Patenaude, Chancellor of the University of Maine System, and truly a friend, colleague, and partner, and champion for Maine Development Foundation. Other people will say it during the day, but the energy in the room today, the energy behind what you saw here and what this organization does really falls to Lori LaChance, and I want to express it on behalf of the University of Maine System and everybody else, my thanks to Lori for her leadership. It's my pleasure to now introduce our keynote speaker this morning, Nick Spitzer, whom we welcome back to Maine. Nick is a professor of anthropology and American studies at Tulane University and the producer and host of American Roots, reaching nearly a million listeners each week on over 265 radio stations and via its website. Nick served as curator for folk festival programs at the Smithsonian, has directed or provided commentary in films about American music, including great performances broadcast on PBS and the Discovery Channel. He has also been a cultural commentator and producer for National Public Radio's All Things Considered and Fresh Air, CBS's Sunday Morning, ABC's Nighttime, and perhaps as important as anything, I've learned that Nick loves Maine. A few years ago, he provided narration for the Kennebec-Chaudière Heritage Corridor Tour CD, a collaborative project with the Maine Office of Tourism and others. Please join me in welcoming our speaker, Nick Spitzer.
Look at this. Look at all this help. This is great. You all look pretty good from up here. Excellent. I like your spirit of democracy. It just moves right forward. You know, no heavy partisan splits here. This is a great thing. I love it. Let me just make sure I'm wired and ready to roll with some of what I've got for you. You've got a little bit of sound there. I, too, want to thank Lori, who's been great. She's been talking to me about coming here for over a year, I think. And I have to say, I wonder, why do people keep inviting me back? I don't know. But I've had a great time over the years, both working with the Folk Festival. I saw John Roman this morning over in Bangor, the American Folk Festival, which started as a Ford Foundation economic development project in part. And we've been involved with the Creative Economy Conference, I think, in Lewiston, the Main Street Maine, and then the Juice Conference, Midcoast Magnet. So I hope I don't repeat myself. You know, when you do public radio, you're always thinking, oh, did I play that before? Have I said that? But then again, most of these things just kind of keep coming around. I will say I also had to experience the last few times that I partly repeated yesterday evening. I came in very late because my plane out of New Orleans didn't arrive on time. That happens in New Orleans occasionally. And but then I had a lost piece of luggage the last time I came up for the Juice Conference. And so I'm struggling. I'm in late. I can't get my luggage. I say, I don't have, like, any clothes for this event. You know, I'll just sleep in my what I'm wearing, whatever. And I said, no, L.L. Bean's open 24/7. So I go to L.L. Bean, get myself a shirt, pair of pants. They tailor my pants. It's like 2 in the morning. Of course, they got nothing to do in the middle of the night. It was not nothing, but certainly they were ready to help me. And then I saw the tent displays with the inflated mattresses, and I'm like, you know, I could just stay here. I'm a little tired. I bet if I asked, they'd probably let me do that. You know, that's the thing I do love about Maine, is when you ask and you need a little bit of help, you just always seem to get it. And I just love that about the place. It's what brings me back almost more than anything, that sense of intimacy and humor and concern for other people. And my sister has lived here many years, and she's seated down here and works at the Southern Maine Community College, so I come for family. But I also come for culture. You know, I work in Southern Louisiana. I work a lot with Afro-French people, Creoles, a lot with Cajuns, and, of course, New Orleans. And I could live as much en français in Northern Maine as I can in Southern Louisiana, quite frankly. And I love it when I get to speak the language and hang out with people, and it's a revelation to see those things happen. You know, I'm somebody that loves signs. I like the old Moxie signs. I like the Dr. Pepper thermometers. I've always followed signs. But I also want to offer one little disclaimer here, which is that I did not take or receive the open for business sign. It's not in my garage in New Orleans. Okay, so you can put a lie detector on me, whatever, but I'm going to say it in front of a group of people. What I wanted to talk to you about today is sort of finding a balance between culture, history, and transformation in society. And I think, you know, I wrote my little Precy statement, and it probably reads a little wonky, but sometimes wonky is good, and it's kind of condenses the sorts of things that have been interesting me most of my life and my work in Louisiana and elsewhere in America and in the world. And, you know, one thing that we learned post-Katrina in New Orleans is the power of culture. There's just no reason to come back after what happened in New Orleans unless you really care about your sense of place, your culture, your neighborhood, many intangible things. And the recovery and the return was built on volunteerism in the wake of, I think, federal malapropisms, even state indifference. But culture is what brought people back. And my view here is that culture is a very powerful thing. And I'm going to try and say a little bit about it and ask you to keep those things in mind as you go forward. It's almost so much a part of life that we tend to forget about what it means. And I want to make a distinction for you that I'll come back to between way of life and quality of life and where they meet up. And I'll be positive at the beginning and say I think that they are in very good shape in this state compared to many, many other places in our country. A few years ago when we did this folk festival, it had come up and we had a meeting in Bangor with people from across the state to talk about what should happen at the event. And I was amazed by the crowd in the room. I was used to jokingly call it the International Federation of Planets because, thinking of the old, you know, Star Trek stuff, because what was there? There was a lobsterman. There was a forester. There were several representatives of French cultures from Acadie and Quebec. There were Passamaquoddy folk. You know, they were people from Indian Island. They were people from, you know, sort of the interior who were good old school Yankees. There was just a wide range of people. But the thing I found most interesting is that almost none of them had ever really talked to one another. And yet they were the leaders of their cultural communities, leaders of their occupational cultures. And it just amazed me that we were having this conversation for the first time. And I know in Louisiana we have a big split between northern Anglo-Louisiana, southern French Louisiana, the more Caribbean New Orleans, all these things. But I was astounded that in a state where everything had always seemed so intimate to me at the level of you know, the bean supper or the flea market or just everybody seeming to know everybody and all kinds of things, or at least knowing who they were kin to, that in this level of discussion, the people didn't really seem to know one another. They reacted to this by having a great time talking to each other. They argued some, but they were all very polite. And when the festival emerged, we drew about, I think, 110,000 people the first year, and the main population was about 1.1 million. I'm thinking, hey, 10% of the state is here. No, I forgot one little secret, which is that all the people from away in the summer boost the population. But nonetheless, 110,000 people over a 2.5-day weekend in Bangor, Maine. Come on, this is a lot of people. And the reaction of the folks was so strong. People that had come from rural areas and had not, been in crowds this big were kind of like looking around and saying, gee, I've never done this, you know. And they were seeing break dancers, and they were hearing country blues and a young teenage French band from Louisiana. But they were also hearing people from within Maine and meeting boat builders and old-time fiddlers and narrators of all kinds. So it was a tremendous event for me. Working in the French scene, a New Year's Portland back in 1989, I stumbled upon a bunch of French fiddlers and I was out scouting for my Carnegie Hall series, Folk Masters, and so I was lucky enough to be able to bring some of those folks to Carnegie Hall. And I fast forward to the Folk Festival again to say this. When I met Governor Baldacci, at the time governor, we just started talking, and he said, Nick, what would you do in Maine cultural policy in a couple of words? And he probably thought I've talked a lot or something. But I said, and you know, Governor, I said, I would try to encourage much more French culture in public. I would encourage connecting to global francité. I would connect to Quebec and Acadie and La Louisiane, hey, Louisiana. And I would really focus on all the amazing things of culture that French people carry. And I would use it as a kind of a counterpoint to the sort of officialized public work ethic we've got. Not to say that there aren't hardworking lumberjacks and farmers and insurance people and hardware store operators among people in the French culture, but to try to bring out music and dance. And so as a result, I kind of built a long string of things that were going on. And I wanted to mention that just about, I think, 2 weeks ago now, Lucien Mathieu, who was one of those French fiddlers, passed away. And I and my sister and others, and including one of his nieces, sent me a news clip of his passing. And I'd been around with Lucien on a number of things. So I thought I should play you a clip from Lucien. Let's see if this thing works here for us this morning. This is a little feature.
The large, often unheard minority of New Englanders are French, Quebecois, and Acadians from Maritime Canada. A lot of French folks have come over the border as fishermen, farmers, lumberjacks, school teachers. We'll hear a song about French Americans living in two worlds in a minute, but first a few words with Lucien Mathieu from Westbrook, Maine, who once told me that he practiced fiddle while working all night in a toll booth on the Maine Turnpike.
I was born in Winslow, Maine, in the good year of 1923. And my father was a fiddler. I played for square dancing, I played for different shows, you know, and we had a good, you know, a real good time at it.
But how is the French music different than the music of the English-speaking people?
I'll tell you, it's livelier. It's got life to it. That's what we like. That's why they all, you see them get up and step dance, you know, because they love to dance to it.
Some of you people are probably from New England.
Actually, let me just say a couple words about him. I mentioned the toll booth. One of the main French fiddlers is the voice that just came popping in there. We seem to have a little hypersensitive sound system here. But one of the band members is Ben Guillemette. And after the Portland encounter, I convinced him to come down to Carnegie Hall, which was its own amusing thing, to get everybody in place and together. And I think they were thrilled that somebody was paying attention. And, of course, thrilled that I had come out of Louisiana to do the work with them because they were familiar with Cajun music. So this is from on stage at Wild Recital Hall at Carnegie Hall, where the Folkmaster series were performed and broadcast. And this is Ben Guillemette just talking to the audience. And one thing I love here is his distinction between New England and then the New England that's in the audience. See if you can catch what he's trying to say here.
Well, of course, some of you people are probably from New England here. And
that surprised him.
And I meant the Upper New England. For some reason,
Upper New England.
I thought, oh, down
not top. Connecticut.
But this is pretty far out from New England, because I don't get out very often. Anyway, I was born and brought up on a farm. And the way it was for us.
Now, is this a French accent?
It was a lot of hard work. But after the work was done on Saturday and Sunday, the families would get together. And in my case, I had a brother that played. My mother played harmonica, and my father played harmonica. And my Uncle Joe played fiddle. And anyway, we used to get together at my grandmother's. It was customary. I'm sure that a lot of you people did the same as we did. And there in the wintertime, of course, in the summertime, we were too busy with the haying and things like that. But in the wintertime, there was more spare time. So over the weekend, Saturday night, the families would gather at the old folks' home. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you know, you'd know, after the homebrew was about half gone, then the Uncle Joe would take his fiddle out. And I remember Uncle Joe, he used to smoke a pipe, and, you know, they used to light like that, and they'd smoke a lot more matches than they did tobacco, you know. Anyway, so the first thing you knew, the stove would go out on the porch, and then they'd start dancing, you know. And so it goes. And that's what brings me over here. After all this thing here, I felt I had to learn to play fiddle. So I'm self-taught, and as you will see later on, that we try to keep the tradition. And in my case, I felt I had no choice but to learn how to fiddle. And as far as the tunes way, the way that we play, we're French Canadians, but as probably you already know, in Canada there's an awful lot of Irish Canadian tunes that are borrowed from the Irish, and you know, I guess we all know that these Irish are some fiddlers. And the Scotch too, huh? Anyway, so as it is, I'd like to play you a number. It's called The Rustic Dance, which was used a lot back in the 20s to dance the buck and wing. A lot of you folks probably know what the buck and wing dance was. But I remember when I was a little kid, there was a fiddler that he played by music, you see. And so he knew all those tunes. He couldn't read them. And I learned that off of him and someone else. I took part of it.
Let's let the rustic dance roll. Maybe you can bring it to the level now. So here they are on stage at Carnegie Hall. What a narration. He talked about family. He talked about work versus play. He talked about ethnic diversity in the relationships between people and the music. He talked about his own learning, how he was self-taught. We find out that he has this enormous vernacular knowledge, what I as a folklorist would call oral literacy. Big difference between that and non-literacy. Oral literacy is about people that are in touch with tradition, know those continuities, and while I'm a huge supporter of education at all kinds of levels, I'm a great believer in the oral literate folk too, because they really are the soul of an awful lot of what we have always cared about in this country, and a group of people that Maine has in great quantity. He represents the native intelligentsia, the native artisan, who is just truly great both within the community, and ultimately you could argue universally if he can get to the stage of Carnegie Hall and entertain us. They do. I love the fact that this is called the rustic dance. What was the turn of the century term for all the people that set up their cottages up there at Mount Desert? Rusticators. Why do we care so much about the past? Why do we have pine knot cabins here on this incredible set of grounds? Why? We could just be in motel rooms here. There's something very important to people about connecting with cultural continuity in all ways. Sometimes you could accuse it of being superficial. Sometimes you could accuse it of being provincial. Sometimes you could say it was brilliant. You could say all kinds of things about what it means to be rustic or go rustic. But it's something that people seem to need to feel connected, to be both in the present and to build a future. You don't seem, in my mind, to be able to do something great in the social order at an economic level, protect the environment, do great education, unless you feel connected to some notion of cultural continuity. And Maine is extremely good about those kinds of things. I'm going to jump forward and say that the last time I had a conversation with a government official about French in Louisiana was when I was at the Main Street Conference in Waterville. And I was sitting next to the mayor, and we started talking a little bit, and then we went out for lunch, and he said to me, I'd been speaking a little bit about the French language side, and he just said, well, you know, there's very little French spoken here in Waterville. We're walking down the street, and this guy comes up and says, hey, comment ça va? I say, c'est pas mauvais, c'est pas, you know, c'est pas rien. I said, not bad, nothing going on. And I turned to him, I said, not much French spoken. And everywhere I turned, I heard French spoken. And I thought it peculiar that the mayor really didn't focus on it. We got back into the hall, and we had a public discussion a little bit about it. And the idea was going to be to put a French museum in downtown Waterville that would sort of show the proud history and culture of the people. And I had to get up and say, folks, here's my quick advice. Don't put in a museum. Help somebody open a restaurant that serves meat pies and have a little dance floor next door, maybe a bookstore. You know, a little bit of history on the walls, sure. But this is a living culture. Just give it a little bit of stimulation and give it some pride on Main Street. As you get concerned about the look of the old buildings downtown here and wonder who will run that general store, don't treat the culture like it's going to go into a museum. Please, please get it out. And that was kind of my message. And in that same moment, I was able to present Al Hawks, a gentleman from Westbrook, Maine, and who was producing records. And I gave a little clip of raw narration, and I've since then produced this piece for American Roots. But let me just say, whatever one thinks of Richard Florida's way of ranking things and deciding where areas are that are appropriate to the creative economy, and I think there's real questions about how well that works for rural areas in particular, and for this vernacular kind of knowledge that I'm talking about, as opposed to the kind of nouveau professionalism. Here was a man who I thought was one more Native intelligentsia member who was quite incredible, and that was Al Hawks. And on Al Hawks's checkoff on the list, one of the things that Florida has is tolerance. And this, to me, this little introduction and commentary with a few minutes gives you a sense of why I believe that.
I'm Nick Spitzer. This is American Roots, our program about records on jukeboxes and the radio and the people who make them. That's Allerton, Al Hawks, on mandolin with his partner, guitarist Alton Myers, on radio in rural Maine around 1950 as the Cumberland Ridge Runners. Al Hawks has had a career bringing country and rock and roll to his native New England, not only as a performer, but also by operating a label called Event Records. Locally, Hawks is known as the Walking Man. That's from a huge sign in front of his old radio and TV business. The Walking Man carried a repair kit on his swinging arm. I asked Al Hawks.
When I was about nine or 10 years old, I enjoyed listening to radio, which we didn't have television, of course, in that era. And there would be cowboys on there and Western singers. And I loved to hear the yodeling and the guitars and the steel guitars and the fiddles. We could pick up the radio stations in Boston. And Georgia May and Jerry and Sky and all of these various country artists. I strung a long wire on a radio between the buildings and the trees to see how many more AM radio stations I could pick up.
It's local high-tech of the era, by the way. It's his own kind of tradition.
About every radio station that was in the New England area had some entertainer that was local. I formed a duet with Alton Myers. My first name is Allerton. So we're Allerton and Alton. The Cumberland Ridge Runners, and we were on radio for five mornings a week from 5:30 to 6, and it was picked up by two or three other stations in Maine.
All right, friends and neighbors, Alton and Alton, the Cumberland Ridge Runners, here again for 15 minutes of fine old time singing and playing. Certainly hope you're going to enjoy.
I played mandolin, he played Martin, six-string guitar, and Alton was black, and I was white. He and I ran into each other at collecting records in used furniture stores where you'd go in and there'd be a pile of old 78 records, and we would just discuss what we had bought during the week or found differently, you know, and we'd get together and play them, and then we formed this duo.
Kentucky.
What about this thing about Kentucky and Maine?
You are the dearest.
It's cosmopolitanism of its own sort.
We were unique in that we were black and white, and then we were doing hillbilly songs then. We had requests come into the radio stations for photographs, and so we had an 8x10 made up, a professional one, and we sent these out. The station manager called me about a week later, said, "We have a problem. We have a number of your mailings coming back saying that's the wrong picture." And I said, "What do you mean it's the wrong picture?" Well, they said there's a black man in the picture, and they don't understand. They're confused. So we had to refund some money. In some cases, I called up people and explained that Alton Myers is Negro. And so one lady said to me in very French accent, she said, "I never knew it. She just kept saying, "I never knew it."
But I'll tell you what, we're going right along in the program here, feature one with Alton, singing a little song here for you. We'll let Alton tell you all about it.
Well, I try this little number. It's pretty stampy as it goes along here. I'll get along somehow. Many months have come and gone since you called me on the phone to tell me that
so there's
we
Alton Myers
were through.
long past.
You thought it'd break my
Al Hawk's
heart,
old buddy,
but I fooled you from
and
the
musical partner on the radio in Maine in the early 1950s. And let's just say this, there were no public black-white radio performances like this anywhere in the United States. I mean, DeFord Bailey was on the Opry, but he was treated kind of like the mascot that played the harmonica. In Louisiana, there were some crossovers, but they were all in the privacy of the recording studio. This was live and toured upon. Tolerance, getting together around what? Old records, rustication. We love 78s. Why do we love that old music that the rest of the country has recorded? And in the case of Al Hawks, why did he love rock and roll so much, and why was he so able to make a great small record company out of the love of music that Mainers had and people throughout New England? He truly is one of the great grand resources, in my mind, of the state. And I love the fact that his wife is like the town treasurer in Westbrook. So, you know, whenever people have these things they do that are culturally expressive, chances are that they're also involved in something to do with not just family, but local economy, local politics. You know the story. You've all been through this. But for somebody visiting every time, it's so refreshing to hear these kinds of things. I want to move along, and somebody did mention the Kennebec River piece, and I'm just going to play you this clip. And I credit the folks that you mentioned in the tourism program, also Kathleen Mundell and Abby Levin, who got out and got some of the field work done on this. But this was an attempt to look at the Kennebec River in cultural and natural terms. Here's a little thing on fiddleheads. We'll give a moment to the fiddlehead lovers.
The Kennebec River begins at Moosehead Lake, the largest lake in Maine. 150 miles later, the Kennebec rolls into the Atlantic Ocean at Popham Beach State Park. The Kennebec generates power for river communities. Artists draw inspiration from its waters. It's valuable for recreation like rafting and fly fishing. And for generations, the Kennebec has been a resource for transportation and food. I'd like to introduce you to three people who have deep connections to the Upper Kennebec. In a moment, you'll hear Barry Dana, a birch bark canoe maker, and painter Abbott Meader. But first, let's visit the edge of the river with Harry Abraham.
We'll just do one.
Harry lives in West Forks, and from the beginning of April to the end of May, you'll find Harry down at the water filling plastic bags with his favorite leafy green, fiddleheads.
These are what we're looking for. Good ones here.
Fiddleheads are edible ferns. You pick them before they unfurl, when they look like the curled end of a violin. Harry's dressed in jeans and a light jacket to stay dry in the spring mist. It doesn't take long to fill a bag. Harry knows where the good ones are.
Okay, let's go right up here. It's a ritual of spring. We start with the fiddlehead, followed shortly by the strawberries. After the strawberries come the raspberries and blueberries. After the blueberries come the blackberries, and then it's partridge season. It's always good to be by the river. The river's been a big part of our lives and probably everybody that ever was associated with the Kennebec Valley. When we speak of everything, we always relate to the river. If we're going to go shopping in Skowhegan, we're going to go downriver. Well, I'd like to say that what everybody does, that everything tastes like chicken, but fiddleheads don't taste like chicken. They're just a green that has a taste pretty much all of their own. Maybe a little to the spinach type thing. I prefer mine with just butter and pepper, but a lot of people put vinegar and some people deep fry them. You can eat them as you pick them.
I'm going to stop for the moment there and just to point out, you know, when we talk about the environmental issues and as such here, I mean, here's somebody who knows how to live off the land. And there are so many people in Maine who know how to do that. And that doesn't usually get factored into questions of household income. Or gather firewood, which doesn't always get factored into questions of how much money goes into expenditures on energy. I think these are deep resources that need to be honored. We can laugh a little about them, but people's ability to continue to use the environment in ways that are appropriate for the domestic economy and for the household are really very powerful things. You know, I grew up in a small town, and with all respect to Ben Guillemette, we thought we were living in New England in Old Lyme, Connecticut. And it was a town of 2,500 people. And, I remember in those days, the town was pretty much, it was a Republican town council, and, everyone described themselves as conservative, but conservative in that context in the 50s and 60s meant conservation. Take care of the birds, help the people over here that don't have what they need, and let's keep this little town together. And I think to me, conservation is, and being conservative is about taking care of your, jarring your vegetables and your fruits and putting something up for the winter and having a mentality of saving something and taking care of it that begins really at that level, not at the level necessarily of how others' lives are lived or what have you. But I see this as conservation of culture to encourage folks like this. But I would argue that in the current moment that we're in, and one reason I do the radio show, is that conservation of culture is such an intangible thing. You cannot just apply a policy to it instantly to encourage it. It has to be something that goes on across the state, just like that gathering of people before the folk festival have to share those ideas and talk about the strengths and weaknesses of where they're at economically, in terms of education, in terms of environment. And culture is the shaping part of the discourse. And so my line is always this, that cultural conservation is really cultural conversation. And conversation is the most fundamental things that humans do, that thinking symbolically, that separate us from the world of animals, wild primates, as my physical anthropology friends call the rest of that world of primates. How do we have that cultural conversation? And one way to do it is to bring forward in media, but in gatherings, in festivals, and assemblies like this, the ability to talk to one another about where we're coming from culturally. And in so doing, I think, begin to transcend some of these divides we've got. I mean, these people all live in modern life. Bless Lucian Matthew is gone. But everybody I'm playing here are people that have lived through the 20th century and are part of contemporary life in different ways. And I can tell you, as I deal with students in Louisiana, and I'm sure you experience this, whether you're at the University of Maine or Southern Maine Community College or Colby Bates, Bowdoin, all these wonderful schools that you've got, the students are extremely interested in this form of knowledge. And so if you look at something like the organic farming movement, you then have the linkage of people that are on the old landscapes that are doing things in new ways for new clientele, maybe as well as their old clientele, and finding ways to get together and synthesize something that came from before but now has new markets and new configurations. And let's not discount the role of the outsider. I know there's a lot of jokes about from away here in Maine. And as somebody that's sort of come in and out, at least I've had the family tie, and I don't say, oh, I grew up in Connecticut. That's great, And I know what they call people from Massachusetts, which is worse yet. But I think sometimes the outside visitor with their different tastes is very stimulating. It can be. It can be a pain. It can be wrong. You can see people being incredibly superficial. But, I also know Mainers who are steeped in tradition who ignore the language. When I'm speaking of French in this case, but I know Mainers who are steeped in local culture who think nothing of, running the gravel trucks by the sacred sites. So there are problems from both the insider and the outsider in terms of both the past and how it translates into the future. It's not a question of from away. But I will tell you one little thing that happened when I was out with the Eastern Maine Development Foundation during the same meetings of the Folk Festival, and Chris Schrum, who some of you probably know, gave me this three-day wild tour of the scene, and we went from lobsters to the rural forest and the old hook and bullet camps, and up on Moosehead Lake, we arrived a little later than we should have. We got behind in our schedule, so we arrive at about 9:45 at night. Everyone's asleep in a five-generation camp where, they were really worried, what are we going to do now? No one's left in the family that wants to do this. The old days of bringing the grandee in to fish and hunt for 2 weeks and feed them and et cetera was shifting over to everyone coming in their SUV and doing their own thing, and the economy of this camp was going away. Once we got everybody was awake and they gave us tours with flashlights, it was kind of a strange mood, and the gentleman who owned the camp kept griping about from away, from away, from away. And, I'm thinking, what the heck am I, chicken salad here, And he was really pretty down on southern coastal Maine and that kind of, that world seemed as odious to him as anything else. And I finally said to him, you've said from away, and you've said, first you were talking about New York, then you were talking about southern New England, now you're talking about southern Maine. I said, where does from away begin? And he says, my property line. I said, okay, now we're clear. No, I wasn't going to try and persuade him like I'll persuade you. I think it's great to have people come here in the summers. It's great for people to move here. You're looking for all kinds of new minds and diversity. But consider this. Who's more from away? The Somali mercantile class or people driving by awfully fast from Massachusetts? And I have been amazed at how many small town stores, especially in southern Maine, seem to be run by Somalis. I'm amazed when I walk down the streets of Portland and I see an old-time classic bar with all the old boys sitting out front. And then by on the street, women in these luscious clothes and jewelry walking by with their kids. And there's the Somali world strikes me as very family-driven and very much about certain kinds of comportment. Not like any group of people. People have their ups and downs. But when in that same conference on Main Street, I said, you know, you're worried about the store in town and who will run it. Maybe you ought to get a Somali family to run the store. It can still look the same. You can still sell the postcards, all those things. So I guess the message here is really be open to the way these different cultural things work out. Okay, let me begin to wrap here. I guess I have been wrapping. Let me wrap up. Last night when I'm coming here on Route 1 and I'm cruising through the towns in the middle of the night, you know, oh, it looks like the prison craft store is closed at midnight. Uh-oh. Get into Camden, all the groovy little coffee shops are kind of down for the night. And I had my tape with me, and I was listening to it, and I have to admit, this is what I put on my car stereo. Some people call it the Maine National Anthem. You know what it is, don't you?
All you big and burly men who roll the trucks along,
I'm in my little SUV,
better listen,
you know.
You'll be thankful when you hear my song. You have really got it made if you're hauling goods any place on earth but those Haynesville woods. It's a stretch of road up north in Maine that's never, ever, ever seen a smile. If they buried all the truckers lost in them woods, there'd be a tombstone every mile. Count them off. There'd be a tombstone every mile.
I'm going to fade this down for the moment. I hate to do that, talk over Dick Curlis. It seems almost sacrilegious. But, you know, this is a song really about the heraldic truck driver. And it comes really out of ancient English balladry, the idea of the traveler and heading to town and the righteous doer of work. And it's a wonderful narration. Of course, it's abetted quite well by the depth of his voice and the sound effects. And, you know, here I am driving along through these towns and night in the rain, you know, with the not too many, you know, it's a little tricky on Route 1 late at night if you've been traveling a long time. And this kind of fortified me for the last 20 miles or so. But, you know, I contrast that reality of lionizing the truck driver and the guy delivering potatoes, as he says, to Boston Town, which is so wonderful, just that sort of locution that he uses, to the oddity that a few years ago when I was canoeing on the Sheepscot that we came up at head tide. And I love places where salt and fresh water come together. Louisiana's great for me for that sense. But here this little dam is, you know, fresh on one side and beginning to be salted with the tide on the other side. And you could have knocked me over with a feather when I saw the historic marker for Edwin Arlington Robinson's house. And I had always loved the poetry. It's dark. It's about a person, I think, a very lonely person. The question of industrialization, moving to Gardner, dissatisfied at Harvard, but certainly becomes one of the great writers in the history of Maine and in the history of the United States. And by the way, at Colby, they have a great collection of his personal artifacts and books and that sort of thing. And what really amazed me, though, was I wanted to go into the house, but it wasn't open that day. And here we are in canoeing clothes and everything. And the thing that struck me, though, was that these gravel trucks are rolling by every 15 minutes or so and rattling the foundations of the whole place. And I thought, why can't a man who wrote about silence and who wrote about contemplation of the night world have a quiet place by his house and the road is encroaching? And so even though I would lionize the truck driver and say, let's think about the work of truck driving and the dangers of the road and the goodness of delivering the crop. I mean, how can you argue with that? But at the same time, maybe we shouldn't have gravel trucks riding by this guy's home place. Maybe we ought to make that a statement about we're gonna have another route. We're just not going to do that here because of Edwin Arlington Robinson. Let's honor that kind of native intelligentsia as well. And I don't think that's been resolved. I thought about doing a piece on All Things Considered about it, and you know, playing some of his or reading some of his poetry. I said, no, this needs to be worked out quietly. Let's let people try and figure this out little by little. And I'm hoping one day it will be figured out. But as you probably know, a rockabilly band named Tom and Jerry, better known later as Simon and Garfunkel, listened to the stories of Edwin Arlington Robinson. And they played one of his songs in a revised version. Here we go. See if I can give you a little bit of this. Okay. Here we go. Just play a little tiny bit of The Tale of Richard Cory, which they turned into a kind of a rock and roll song, all by Edwin Arlington Robinson. Go on with the song right this moment, but you probably know the story of the factory workers lionizing Richard Cory and how imperially thin he is and how up with style he is and how he gives to charity, but then how despondent the workers are because they scuffle for meat and for bread, and in the end, the last line of the poem, they're shocked one morning to wake up and find that Richard Cory has taken his own life. And it's just an amazing sort of composite poem that obviously Robinson is dealing with, the question of what happens when your whole life becomes this kind of high and mighty presence, but you're not necessarily connected to community. And it's a jarring poem, and it's a scary poem in certain ways. But I think it's one that we have to be mindful about. It, to my way of thinking, it's really not about growth per se for a place. It's what do you grow into? What do you become? And do you become something that feels connected to what has been and what is? And, you know, you reject the provincialism and you reject non-literacy and you reject misuses of the landscape that may go with some aspects of tradition, but you try to find out who are the people who are orally literate, who are people where their traditions can be modified and put into places that will aid and abet the larger populace. How do we remain diverse a la Maine, but also become diverse in the larger world? Infrastructure is a means to an end. It's not an end in and of itself. Boy, did we learn that in New Orleans. You know, I know no native New Orleanian and nobody that came there after Katrina who said, I'm coming for great infrastructure. That place is, you know, as rickety as it gets, you know. At the same time, it has deep soul and deep music and deep architecture and deep food and a deep sense of community. And that's what people came back for. And I, of course, prayed nothing like that ever happens in Maine. But you know what? This place has got all those things, too, in different ways. And it's something to be incredibly proud of. It's the reason I come back, not just for family, but because I love Maine and its cultures, and I always want to hear and see more every time I come. Sure, I love to get out in the environment. That's part of it, and the connection of cultural conservation to literal conservation is a powerful connection. But here's what I would say is, as we chart up the qualities of life that we want good education, we want a clean environment, you know, we want planned growth, you know, we want to have a place where, you know, we have great modern things. Think about the way of life, because the way of life has been a quality of life indicator that's drawn people here for many, many years, whether it was Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard, and all the rusticators at Mount Desert, or people just coming today into this state. So quality of life comes down to something special. Not everyone's aware of the French culture like me or Al Hawks or all the things that we love, but I think everybody who comes to Maine recognizes not just the beauty of the place, but the intimacy of the place. How people get things done at a sort of lateral, intimate level, whether it's the bean supper or just everybody seems to know somebody that knows somebody, and a lot gets done that way. And that is a very, very precious commodity. So I began by making a little joke about open for business and the sign and all the problems that attended to the stealing, I guess, of the sign. Let me say this. What I would promote about Maine, without having to herald it too much, is just to say that many, many people still here live here with their doors unlocked. And in America, where there's so much strife and trouble, the idea of doors unlocked is a very powerful thing. But what happens when so many people come that you don't feel like you can, you know, there's too many strangers? I think Maine has a way of handling that. You know, the lobsterman I had interviewed, which I didn't even play for you, had been here 50 years and was Jewish from Brooklyn, New York, and he spoke with a Maine accent, as I hear it. You heard Ben Guillemette. Did you hear the French in that? No, he's like second generation, where he's perfectly bilingual and perfectly bicultural. There's no interference across there at all. Mainers have had a great ability, I think, to absorb, to transform, to find some essence of Maine based around these kinds of intimacies. So I simply suggest, as you go forward, find those balances between way of life and the quality of life where we can check it off and say this is a really great thing. Certainly we all have to think about those things. And I have confidence, just hearing the things that have been said already and talking to Lori and the crew here, that all these things are going to continue forward into the future and that the cultural conversation will be at the center of the future of what Maine becomes. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that unfolds. Thanks for listening to me this morning. I appreciate it.
All right. You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today's speaker was Nick Spitzer, host of the radio program American Roots. He spoke in Northport at the Maine Development Foundation's annual meeting in September. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Nick Spitzer, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. For Speaking in Maine, I'm John Kiner.